inviting diverse thought leaders to explore topics designed to spark our collective imagination. Welcome to AKQA Insight.
Boutique hotelier who helped Airbnb's founders turn their fast-growing tech startup into a global hospitality brand, Chip Conley is a New York Times best-selling author whose manifesto on ageism, Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, is inspired by his experience of being both a mentor and an intern in his 50s. After selling the company he started at age 26, Chip wasn't sure what was next. He could have retired at age 52, but the young founders of Airbnb came calling. He served as Airbnb's head of global hospitality and strategy for 4 years, while also being CEO Brian Chesky's mentor, and continues today as a strategic advisor to the company's leadership. While writing Wisdom at Work, Chip was inspired to build the world's first midlife wisdom school, the Modern Eldern Academy. Chip is an active mentor to 6 young CEO founders in the hospitality and tech world, serves on the board of Encore.org and the advisory board for the Stanford Center for Longevity.
So fixed mindset is about proving yourself. A growth mindset is about improving yourself. And the definition of success is not winning, it's learning. And so why is a growth mindset really valuable for people? Well, it means that you are open to being in a transitional state, learning something new, having a beginner's mind, looking a bit awkward and like an idiot at times. So when you start to look at your life and say, oh my gosh, I have a lot of adult life ahead of me, it allows you to be open to maybe learning some new things because you know you have a long time ahead of you to learn it.
I'm your host for today, Amy Oliver, Chief People Officer at AKQA, and I've had the pleasure of reading Chip's latest book, Wisdom at Work. Chip's own story of growth and transformation in midlife is inspiring and offers a raw view of what it's like to reimagine your career at any age. In the book, he not only shares his own experience, but offers advice to others as they look to define the second half of their lives. I'm interested in his perspective on the gap the modern elder is filling in the current workforce and how we can all rethink our mindset and professional value in the second half of our lives. Hi, Chip. It's so great to welcome you to AKQA Insight.
I'm honored to be with you. Thank you.
Great. So can we just start by, can you explain what is a modern elder?
Good question, because quite frankly, when I was first called a modern elder at Airbnb, I took offense to it. So first, let's define elder versus elderly. Elderly is probably the last 5 or 10 years of your life. Elder is a relative term. It basically means that you are older than the people around you. So I joined Airbnb at age 52, and the average age was 26. But when the founders called me the modern elder, their premise was a modern elder is as curious as they are wise. And we coined the term that I was a mentor. I was both a mentor and an intern at the same time. So a modern elder is somebody who realizes that they are constantly learning and they're developing wisdom over time, but they need to understand the context in which for them to actually share that wisdom. So generally speaking, a modern elder is somebody who is able to at times be the most curious one in the room, and at other times be the wisest one in the room. And having both of those qualities is both valuable to that person, but also to an organization.
So the book and insights are based on your personal experience. Can you tell us a little bit about the transition from CEO of your own hotels to head of global hospitality and strategy for a relatively new startup?
Yeah. So I had at age 26, I'd started a company called Joie de Vivre. It became the second largest boutique hotelier in the U.S. And then 24 years into it, at about age 50, I decided I was fed up and didn't want to do it anymore. It was the Great Recession, and I moved on. And it was a couple years later that the founders of Airbnb approached me and asked me if I wanted to help them democratize hospitality, which sounded intriguing. But I didn't really know anything about the tech industry or Airbnb. It was a small tech startup at the time. And I was based in San Francisco, as were they, so it was convenient. But the thing that was so surprising to me is I arrived and I realized, wow, I am a lot older than everybody here. They're speaking a language. Some of the language is tech lingo. Some of it's millennial lingo that I didn't necessarily understand because I was a boomer. And but more than anything, I think what I really saw was that I had to shift my identity. I'd been and you don't have to be a CEO who's moving into a new role to shift your identity. For me, that was my issue, was that I had been CEO of a company I'd started, ran it for 24 years, and then all of a sudden, now I'm no longer the sage on the stage, I'm the guide on the side. And so I had to really right-size my ego, but more importantly, actually I had to shift my thinking and evolve and edit what I knew. And that meant like taking a lot of my historical hotel knowledge and realizing it wasn't going to be all that valuable in the home sharing world. And so being discerning about that and understanding what I needed to let go of and what I needed to learn allowed me to be, you know, within my first few months there, somebody who was often asking the most catalytic questions in the room, as opposed to the old guy dispensing wisdom. So it really required an identity cleanse of who I was. I'm no longer the CEO in charge of the company. I'm no longer the person getting a lot of press written about him. I'm the person sort of behind the scenes helping these three founders hopefully create a great company.
So a lot of times there's a moment where everything comes together and you see the vision. In this case, the vision was the idea of a modern elder. Did you have an aha moment, or was it a series of events and reflection that formed the perspective?
You know, it was the day that Brian Chesky, who's the co-founder of Airbnb and the CEO, and I was his mentor, but he was also mentoring me in certain ways. It was the day he said to me, about 2 months into it, he said, "Chip, you're the head of global hospitality and all in charge of all of our hosts, and here's the other things you're in charge of, but now I want you to be in charge of strategy for the company as well." And I looked at him and I said, "Brian, I've never worked in a tech company before, and you want me to be in charge of strategy?" And he said, "Yeah, we hired you for your knowledge, but what we really got was your wisdom." And that was a curious thing to say, because I had never really thought about the difference between knowledge and wisdom. And what he said is, you're able to somehow zoom up 30,000 feet in the air and see the future better than the rest of us. We're so focused, we are just so in the moment, in the weeds, that we can't sort of see what this looks like a year from now. And it's like you have pattern recognition, having been an entrepreneur and been around the hospitality business a long time, such that you can actually help us see things that we wouldn't have seen otherwise. So that's when I started to realize, wow, there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. And that was the light bulb above my head saying, ah, it was 1959 that Peter Drucker, who I think was a modern elder, very curious and wise, famous management theorist, said that the future of the workplace is going to be defined by knowledge workers. And nobody knew what the heck he was talking about in 1959, because computers were, you know, the normal size of a computer was the size of a bedroom. But he was true. He was right, because, you know, here we are 61 years later, and 7 of the 10 most valuable companies in the world today are tech companies, and knowledge workers do rule the world. What I started to see with Brian is that we're awash in knowledge, and there were so many knowledgeable, data-centric people in this company, in Airbnb, but what the company was desperately in need of was some wisdom, and wisdom is sort of distilling the knowledge down to what's important and essential. And so actually, the light bulb went on for me when I said, wow, maybe it's time for us to retire the term knowledge worker and to replace it with wisdom worker, because what we are going to see in the future with 5 generations in the workplace for the first time is a new kind of intergenerational collaboration that is different than the past. 40% of in the U.S., I don't know what it is like in the U.K. and the rest of the world, but in the U.S., 40% of the U.S. has a boss that's younger than them. And if you're 55, 70% of people have a boss younger than them. And by the year 2025, the majority of Americans will have a boss younger than them. We need to learn how to create like an intergenerational potluck where each of the five generations in the workplace today can bring what they can to the work to the table. And I think the older you are, the more you have maybe a little bit of emotional intelligence, pattern recognition, wisdom to bring to the table, but you're going to be learning from the younger people. And if you are not enough curious enough and open enough to being humble enough to realizing that sometimes the younger people are going to teach you a few things, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. So that's when I started to realize, gosh, at some point I better write a book about this, because there are going to be more and more people who are older and trying to figure out how to stay relevant, because we live in a world where we're going to live longer, but power seems to be moving younger and the world is changing faster. And I think we need to create an environment where people in midlife know how to repurpose themselves in ways that make them relevant and valuable in the workplace.
So you've mentioned wisdom a few times. Can you tell me about wisdom and the modern elder? What is the relationship?
So let's talk about knowledge and wisdom. I mean, first of all, if you sort of looked at a pyramid, you know, you'd have like data and information at the base of the pyramid. There's a lot of that. And from that comes maybe some knowledge or insight. And then above that would be wisdom. So knowledge is sort of something that's almost, to use a metaphor, knowledge is like an arithmetic equation. You gain knowledge, you actually just constantly are adding new knowledge. But the thing that is different about wisdom is taking knowledge and distilling down what's truly important. So it's almost like a division equation, a plus. It's a division symbol. And what does that mean? It means you actually take the knowledge you have, and sometimes you take the experience you have, and you distill it down to what really seems important and essential. And then you use that pattern recognition and you apply it moving forward. So to me, wisdom is a way of saying you can see the future. You can actually see a pattern of something that helps you understand what the future is going to be like, which allows you to adapt accordingly. So it can be very valuable this is part of the reason why I guess Brian wanted me to be head of strategy, because here's an interesting thing that a lot of people don't know. We know that the aging brain, as it gets older, is not as good at memory or as quick as it used to be. But the thing that a lot of people don't know, and this has been studied and pretty much verified at this point by all kinds of social scientists as well as brain scientists, is that as you get older, you start doing what some people call the left brain, right brain tango, which is the ability to think holistically and move from logical to lyrical all in the same sentence. What that means is you're more adept at understanding your whole brain, thinking holistically, thinking systemically, and connecting the dots. It's also called crystallized intelligence. Crystallized intelligence is something that you get better at up till about age 65 or 70. So, and how is that valuable? Well, crystallized intelligence is the ability to see patterns, to see and understand insights that are not obvious to somebody who's less experienced. This does not mean that the only wise people in the world are people who are older, because you and I both know people who are old and not very wise. So it's something you can cultivate at any age, but if you can cultivate it, you can build the wisdom, build the pattern recognition, and what that allows you to do is to really be exceptionally good at prioritizing. And in a company like Airbnb that was growing quickly, had all kinds of opportunities associated with its growth, part of my role was to help Brian say no to a lot of things. And when I joined, we had 30 different strategic initiatives, but within 6 months, we had culled it down or edited it down to just four. And we just focused on doing those four things really well.
So what are some ways that people show wisdom? I think you just mentioned prioritization. Is that part of identifying wisdom, or what are some other ways in which people show this characteristic?
Wisdom often it can very often show up in sort of an emotional intelligence kind of way, like an EQ way, in the sense of being able to interview someone for a job, I actually think wisdom in job interviewing is a really important talent, and one that often is better with someone who's been around a little bit longer and built some people wisdom. So for me, wisdom in the form of understanding that, trying to be able to understand the collateral costs and benefits of things. So there may be somebody who's interviewing for a job and they're just awesome in answering questions, and it feels like they're really polished and they know their stuff. But wisdom would be understanding what is beneath the surface that isn't coming out yet. And therefore, what kind of questions could you ask that might actually put this person a little off balance, such that you could see them in a less polished way? I like to ask the question in job interviews with people, what's the number one way in the workplace that you're often misperceived? And it's a very interesting question, and it's one that most people haven't heard before, and it forces people to actually show a level of self-awareness, and to frankly also help them to say, here's how other people perceive me that isn't sometimes accurate, and it opens us up to a series of questions that allow us to sort of get underneath the surface of the polish. So I think wisdom is being able to understand collateral costs and benefits and not focus just on the thing directly in front of your face. It's being able to see the pattern recognition such like, okay, I can see the future. If we stay on this path, this is what things are going to look like a year from now. It's very interesting that most famous futurists in the world are not young people. They are old people. And it's partly because they've sort of seen something and they've built a pattern recognition and an intuition. How else does wisdom show up? Wisdom often shows up in looking for solutions that are not self-centered, or that actually have a greater whole attached to them. This is in the wisdom studies world, it's a little more controversial of a subject, but generally speaking, most people who study wisdom believe that a wise person tends to think of the social good around decisions that are made. Not everybody agrees with that. Some people say wisdom has nothing to do with social good, but generally, I think most people would say wisdom is less self-centered, and it's more focused on often focused on what's the long-term benefit of something as opposed to the short-term benefit.
Book, you coined a term mentoring, which I loved, by the way. Can you explain what that is and how it fits into the idea of a modern elder?
Sure. Why did you love it?
Why did I love it? Because I recognized it on a little bit on a personal level. I think you're always learning, and I'm new to this. You know, I'm new to AKQA, which you know, and so I'm learning a lot right now. So it was something recognizable to me, and so I loved the term.
Well, it's sort of it's think. Did you ever watch the movie The Intern with Robert De Niro and Anne Hathaway?
Yes.
Yeah, great movie. And the thing that is funny about that movie is that Robert De Niro came in as a senior intern at age 70, and to be the intern to a 34-year-old CEO, Anne Hathaway. But the reality is, he was as much a mentor to her as he was an intern. And so that's when I saw the movie while I was working with Brian, and I was mentoring Brian, but often I was interning because I didn't understand the tech business. And so I believe the future of learning and development in companies is going to be very much about mutual mentorship. And so in order to be a mutual mentor, it means you're sometimes the mentor, sometimes the intern. Using technology, I think companies are going to get smarter and smarter about how do you match make two people, one who has really strong knowledge in one area but needs to know this other area, and the other person's the yang to the yin. They know the thing that person needs to know, but they absolutely need to learn something that person knows. And if we can move in a direction where we start to matchmake mutual mentorship, and in essence, everybody becomes a mentor, what we are doing is we're actually, from a financial perspective in a company, we may actually be able to reduce our learning and development costs. But more importantly, we probably create some alliances in the company that might not have existed otherwise. And often these alliances are across generations. So, when in doubt, go watch The Intern and realize that everybody in that movie was actually learning from somebody else.
Right. And this, you mentioned earlier just about it, we talk a lot about this being the modern elder, so maybe the midlife and above, but you could probably be a mentor at a different stage of your life as well if you're playing that role for somebody else that is less experienced.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yes. Yeah, you could be. I mean, I think there's two sides to the mentor, because someone could be the younger person and be the mentor, or the older person, because it's both mentor and intern. But as I said earlier, I think that the idea of an elders, has a lot of baggage attached to it as a word. So I recognize that. But whether you're an elder at age 40 because you're surrounded by 20-year-olds, or you're, as I was at 52 7 years ago, surrounded by 26-year-olds, you are, relatively speaking, the person who has more experience. But that doesn't necessarily mean you have more knowledge. And so the knowledge we had at Airbnb, Brian and I laughed because he said, "Chip, we have a trade alliance. You provide me EQ, emotional intelligence, and I provide you DQ, digital intelligence." And in a world where more and more companies are exceptionally focused on DQ, digital intelligence, learning how to match a young digital leader who's damn good at what they do, but is missing a little bit of the EQ, could be a really great idea for the company, because what it does is it helps to microwave the leadership skills and emotional intelligence of that young digital leader who may be smart as heck about what they know, but doesn't know how to run a meeting, doesn't know how to manage a person, and frankly has a personality that turns people off.
I want to move on, and let's talk a little bit about the U-curve and the life stages you discuss in the book. It kind of sets the stage for this idea of reinventing yourself. Can you explain that a little bit?
So there's been, over the last 100 years, lots of psychology and sociology on life stages. And so one of the things that has been looked at is midlife. So midlife has a bad brand. So Amy, when you hear the word midlife, what's the natural next word you say after midlife?
Probably old.
Well, that's good. That's good. That isn't what I was expecting, but that clearly shows it has a bad brand. Midlife does have a bad brand, because most people would answer that with midlife crisis. So the idea of midlife, if you were to say midlife, fill in the blank, the second word, a lot of people would say crisis. And that term came from 1965, and midlife was sort of a new thing, because in the 20th century, we added 30 years of life to the average person in Western society. So the average longevity in the year 1900 was 47, and it was 77 in the year 2000. So midlife was sort of a modern creation, and there was very little in the way of support, school, tools, anything to help people in midlife. So what became clear in the last 20 years, based upon a series of social science studies, is there's this U-curve of happiness. People starting in their early to mid-20s see a slow decline in their life satisfaction, until about age 45 to 50. And around 45 to 50 or 52, that range, people bottom out. And then for every decade after that, people are happier. People are happier in their 50s than their 40s, happier in their 60s than 50s, and happier in their 70s and 60s. And actually women in their early 80s are happier than their 70s. So what's going on there? Why is there this U-curve? Why does it actually bottom out around 45 to 50? And what can we take from that? There are a few reasons for this, and I wrote about this in Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, and it's part of the reason we created this Modern Elder Academy, which we'll talk about. Part of what's going on is around that point, people often are just overwhelmed with everything. They have accumulated. They've spent their life accumulating knowledge, accumulating responsibilities, jobs, extracurricular activities, children, responsibilities in the sandwich generation, taking care of their parents, but also taking care of their kids. They're in a place, frankly, where they don't have a lot of space in their life. So life becomes a bit of a transaction because there's not enough space. But what do they need to do? And this is what I call the great midlife edit. Because the first half of your life is about accumulating. The second half of your life is about editing. You have to actually, around 45 to 50, start to look at what is it that's no longer serving you? What's the knowledge that you just need to let go of? What are the identities of the past that don't work for you? What's the mindset that isn't working for you either? And by so doing, you start to actually lighten your load a little bit. I mean, from a physical perspective, this is also a time when sometimes we see people downsizing. Sometimes in people's early 50s or mid-50s, maybe their kids, maybe they're in the suburbs and their two or three kids have gone off to college or moved out. And it's like, oh, let's go buy a condo, you know, in the city and we'll get rid of our suburban big home. So that downsizing is another form of editing. So I think one of the things that I've learned using just talking to, you know, some of the best psychologists and social psychologists in the world who've written great books about this is that the liberation that people tend to feel in their 50s is also a liberation of stopping worrying about what other people think of them and just like living your life on your own terms. It's amazing it takes as many decades as it does. But I think one of the things that happens in people's 40s is also the equation disappointment equals expectations minus reality. Expectations, through your 20s, 30s, and 40s, you may have expectations. I'm going to be president someday. I'm going to, you know, have the ultimate soulmate as a husband or wife. My kids are going to be perfect. I'm going to live in, you know, in the dream home, etc. And it's in your 40s when you can sort of see the future and you say, like, you know what? Some of those expectations aren't going to happen. And that's the time when people, frankly, Brené Brown calls it the midlife unraveling. You unravel all of these expectations and get back down to what's important. So it's a very important period of people's lives because, frankly, a lot of people are going through this pain and suffering on their own, not realizing it's actually normal.
So when I, like, what's really interesting to me about these concepts, so the U-curve, the life stages, the editing, is when I read it, I was well aware that I was reading a book that had a professional slant to it, but I felt like a lot of it really was more around personal development. And like the idea that I really wish I would have read this probably when I was 38, right? Versus today, like understanding that before you head into that, would have been really interesting. And you wonder, like, would I have edited earlier? Would I have understood the importance of that? So I just, I found it like this side tangent of thought I was having when I was reading the book around what is the person, like, if I take the professional value and how you apply wisdom at work, there was this whole other tangent my mind was going on around the personal aspects of it.
You know, what's interesting, Amy, is we don't have a roadmap of life. You know, if you're like driving down the road and there's like a hairpin turn or there's a slippery one wet, or, you know, we have signs up that sort of help you to understand what's ahead. But when it comes to how we live our lives and the life stages, it's not like we have some school when you hit age 40 that says, okay, this is what's going to happen in your 40s. So this is actually part of the reason why I think reading books, talking to people. Men do this very poorly. Women are much better about socializing their vulnerability and checking in with others about, you know, what's going on for them. And this is, you know, ultimately, this is part of the reason why I created the Modern Elder Academy as sort of an academy that helps people. Just like the word adolescence was created in the year 1904. It didn't mean that people weren't teenagers before 1904, but before 1904, when you hit puberty, you were an adult. You got married maybe by the time you're 15, and you had a baby before you're 18, and you If you're a guy, you probably worked in the mines or in a factory before you were 18. And then adolescence as a word got coined, and the premise behind adolescence was this is a time for emotional and hormonal and physical changes. And it's a preparatory time for you to become an adult, because we have three eras in our life, childhood, adulthood, and elderhood. So from that led to American and frankly in most of the world, public schools and high schools were created so that people could actually prepare themselves for adulthood and get educated. Well, what we haven't seen until the last 10 or 20 years is a word called middlescence. Adolescence is the corollary from childhood. Middlescence is when you go through emotional and spirit and hormonal and physical changes, often between the ages of 45 and 55 or 60, when you are in the midst of a shift and you're in the midst of a preparatory time to becoming an elder or going into elderhood. But we have zero in the way of schools and tools and rites of passage or rituals that help people to know they're going through that. Whereas if you're a teenager, being a teen's tough and going through adolescence is not easy, but there's a lot of support for adolescence. There's not a lot of support for middlescence. And it's part of the reason why the midlife from age 45 to 65, midlife suicide rate is up 50% compared to what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think I saw that. I mean, that statistic is really staggering, actually. Again, going back to, I think it would have been, I would have equally appreciated this book when I was 39. So, and know what was ahead. So let's talk a little bit, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about growth mindset. You talk a lot about this growth mindset and building the modern elder. Can you just tell me a little bit about how that fits in?
Sure. So there's a woman named Carol Dweck. She's a psychologist from Stanford, and she's popularized the idea that people can either have a fixed or a growth mindset in their life. And it just depends on which part of your life, because you could have a fixed mindset in certain parts of your life and a growth mindset in others. When you have a fixed mindset, your tendency is to focus on proving yourself. You feel like you have a fixed amount of skill or talent, and you do your best with what you've got. And the definition of success is winning. So you're proving yourself and you're trying to win. Now, I don't know about you, Amy, but that sounds familiar. That's sort of like how I grew up. It's like, okay,
right. Uh-huh.
That's exactly like, okay, yeah. And have I been like that in my adulthood? Yeah, I guess I have at times. Well, here's the challenge with that. As you get older, there's some things you're not as good at as you get older, especially physical, you know, sports and physical things. And so if your premise is you have a fixed amount of skill or ability and you only do things that you can win, over time your sandbox gets smaller and smaller because you actually don't try new things. So the opposite of that is the growth mindset. So a fixed mindset is about proving yourself. A growth mindset is about improving yourself. And the definition of success is not winning, it's learning. And so why is a growth mindset really valuable for people? Well, it means that you are open to being in a transitional state, learning something new, having a beginner's mind, looking a bit awkward and like an idiot at times, like I did at Airbnb. I mean, if I'd had a fixed mindset after the first week at Airbnb, I would have quit because I could feel I was such an idiot when it came to understanding tech lingo and the tech world. And so I had to adopt this growth mindset, the idea, okay, I'm going to learn something here and I'm going to grow as a result of that. And what that did is it helped me be comfortable with the idea of not being the smartest person in the room and occasionally feeling like I was, you know, just not very good at what I was doing. But if I could actually see progress along the way, there's a great book called The Progress Principle written by a couple Harvard Business School professors. And what they were able to show in their studies is that people, generally speaking, are happier in work and in life when they feel like they're making progress. And so to have a growth mindset is to have a point of view that you can constantly be learning. So I'm 59 years old now, and I'm learning how to surf. That is not something a 59-year-old normally does. And I'm also learning Spanish, but I live in Mexico half the time. So it's like the question I ask myself is like, well, if I don't learn Spanish now and I live in Mexico, it's not going to be any easier 10 years from now. So both of those things are not easy. But if I look at my life, doctors have told me this, and then this website that's pretty sophisticated takes all your data about your health, your DNA, et cetera. They say that I'm probably going to live till 98 years old, let's say, which is a long time. That's longer than I expected. So let's say I'm going to live till I'm 98. Well, if I'm going to live till I'm 98 and I'm 59 now, and what percentage of my adult life, if I start counting at age 18, is ahead of me? Well, the math is this, is I have barely entered the second half of my adult life. Because if I'm going to live till 98, I have 80 years of adulthood from 18 to 98, and I am almost halfway would be 58. So when you start to look at your life and say, oh my gosh, I have a lot of adult life ahead of me, it allows you to be open to maybe learning some new things because you know you have a long time ahead of you to learn it. There's a great TED Talk by Dan Gilbert that he gave in 2014, I believe, about the future self. And what he was able to show, people dramatically underestimate how much change they have ahead of them in their next 10 years. And so I think that, what a growth mindset says is like life is meant to grow and change and to be liminal, a word that I learned, which means you're in transition.
So I really enjoyed our conversation and your insights. So but I'll close with one last question. What's next for you?
So when I left a full-time job at Airbnb 3 months ago, I knew that I was onto something about this modern elder thing. The fact that they'd called me that, and then I had to own it, and then I could see a lot of my friends were in midlife and struggling. And so I came down to Mexico, to the southern Baja Peninsula, about an hour north of Cabo San Lucas, where I have a home on the beach. And I started writing this book, which is my fifth book, called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. While I was writing the book, I came to this conclusion, like, wow, why do we not have a midlife wisdom school, a place where people go, especially if they lose their job, or especially if they've just gotten divorced, or they are going through menopause, or they are just becoming an empty nester? Where do you go to sort of like reimagine how to live your life based upon a lot of the principles we've talked about today? So I decided to create, January of 2018, a beta test down here in Mexico on a beachfront campus that we created. And for the next 6 months, we had 13 different cohorts that went through 1 or 2 week programs, and it was very successful. So we opened to the public in the fall of 2018, and we're closed right now because of the pandemic, but we've had 800 people from 24 countries go through the program, and we use Net Promoter Score, NPS, as our metric for customer satisfaction. We have a 94 NPS, which is like crazy, because, Ritz-Carlton's like 78, or Apple's 74, and the average for the hotel industry is like 45. So so we're really proud. We've tapped into something that is needed, and it's a social enterprise, which means that over half the people who come are on some form of scholarship we give them. So you can learn more about that at modernelderacademy.com.
I think that's really exciting. And as I mentioned before, I imagine that the experience for the people that go are both professionally and personal. So I just think there's such a blend in the themes of your book and what you're doing there, that kind of between those two different worlds, I think it's really interesting. So, thanks again, Chip, for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been my pleasure to host you on AKQA Insight.
Thank you. It's been a joy. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks for listening, and please join us for the next episode of AKQA Insight.